This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Nobody had to declare Super Bowl Sunday a national holiday because it happens on Sunday. But the day has assumed a status and size undreamt of even in NFL boardrooms 50 years ago. You love football, you hate football, doesn't matter. For a day, the NFL warts and all rules. And except for the malcontents sitting in near-empty movie theaters, we are all at the party together. But this year, the Super Bowl is more contentious than usual. That's because the New England Patriots are in it again. The Pats, they are God's gift to America or lying, cheating scum, depending on whom you ask. How did that happen? How did the Patriots become the team that almost everybody outside of New England loves to hate? Only a Game's Karen Givens spent this week trying to get to the bottom of that question. Her quest began in Nashua, New Hampshire.
Hi there.
Randy.
How are you?
Karen. Nice
to meet
you.
Great to meet you. On a new state.
Randy Pierce opens the door and invites me into his large living room. The walls, floor to ceiling, are covered in framed jerseys, signed photos, and life-size decals of Patriots players. The couches are arranged around a big screen TV. Randy's dog, Autumn, sits patiently, a respectable distance from the door.
Okay, can I tell her she can say hello?
Absolutely.
Okay, gentle. Okay. Good girl.
Back in December of 2001, Randy was named New England Patriots Fan of the Year. The team was different then. They'd been to a couple Super Bowls, but had never won. In September, their veteran quarterback, Drew Bledsoe, had been injured on a hit that had sheared an artery behind his ribs and could have killed him. He was replaced by an unknown second-year backup named Tom Brady. Randy says the team was so sure that the season wasn't going anywhere that they had scheduled Old Foxborough Stadium for demolition the day after the regular season ended.
We are so caught up in this mindset of negativity. Of course, there's no chance we could have another game. There really was a culture and a mindset of defeat and loss.
But to almost everyone's surprise, Foxborough Stadium was pressed into service one more time for a divisional playoff game on January 19th, 2002. No one could have known then that this game, and in particular a controversial call in the fourth quarter, would be the beginning of a Patriots dynasty, and that it would set the stage for a series of controversies that would turn the Patriots into the most hated team in the NFL. Randy Pierce and his friends arrived at their favorite tailgating spot across the street from the stadium at 2 o'clock that day. Nobody gave Tom Brady and the Patriots much of a shot in that game against the Oakland Raiders, not even Randy. But that was before the weather changed.
As 4 o'clock rolled around, I remember watching the snow fall. And when you live in New England, snow just has this magical quality for your team. And our record in the snow is kind of amazing. That started making people think a little more, you know, this isn't the way bad things happen for us. This is the way good things happen for us.
By kickoff, the grounds crew was already using leaf blowers to try to keep the yard lines visible. Randy hoped the weather would encourage the running game, which might benefit the Patriots. But nobody could get any traction to run in the snow. And the Raiders were throwing the ball really well.
And they're wearing white jerseys, and the guy sitting next to me says, you know, I can't even see their receivers because the white of their jersey, and they had kind of silvery numbers, I guess, just got lost. He says, I sure hope our defenders can see them better than I can.
The Patriots managed to keep the game within reach until late in the third quarter, when the Raiders kicked a 45-yard field goal to increase their lead to 13-3. For some Patriots fans infected by that culture of defeat and loss, a late-game 10-point deficit and the rising snowdrifts were just too much to take.
Spirits are low, and, you know, it makes you start to feel it a little bit. It wasn't really cold, but you're wet, so it starts to get a little unpleasant. Some people are even leaving, although, you know, there's 60,000 people there, and 180,000 will tell you they never left that day, right? But
they left.
They did leave. Not a lot, but there were some people who were leaving.
But in the fourth quarter, Brady scrambled for 6 yards and a touchdown, and the Patriots were within 3 again. A couple of possessions later, the Raiders switched to their running game to eat up time, and the Patriots stopped them.
So now they punt the ball back. We've got the ball back with very little time left. You know, ultimately, Tom's got it with, I think, 206 when we take over.
Brady threw a 7-yard pass and then scrambled for 5 yards. The Patriots had just under 2 minutes to get within field goal range and tie the game, but...
But there's a fumble.
First down from the 42. Blitz. Lost the football. It's on the ground. Covered by the Raiders.
And I'll tell you the truth. All of us thought it's a fumble. And if I watched that play and could see it, I'd tell you it's a fumble.
I should probably mention that Randy Pierce has been completely blind since September 14th, 2000. He watches games by listening to the radio call to get a mental picture and sits next to a friend who fills in the blanks. And you might be wondering why I've asked a blind man to describe what would become one of the most controversial calls in NFL history. But here's the deal. Everyone who watches that play sees the same thing. It looks like a fumble, at least at first. Former Patriots lineman Damian Woody had a pretty good view. He was on the field.
I saw Charles Woodson in my periphery, and I'm like, oh boy, this is not gonna end well. And when the ball came out, I thought the game was over.
Rewatching the play in slow motion from the broadcast booth, Phil Simms and Greg Gumbel agreed.
And Beekert picks himself up, falls on the football, and has pretty much sealed an Oakland Raider victory here in New England.
With less than 2 minutes left in the game, the call was subject to an automatic review. Head referee Walt Coleman went under the hood to watch the replay, and Damian Woody began to have reason to hope.
Then I looked at the sideline, and you could just hear whispers from the sideline, and you start hearing about the tuck rule.
The tuck rule was so new, it had only been invoked once, that Phil Simms was having trouble remembering its name. But Simms and Gumbel were pretty sure that what they were seeing on replay didn't apply.
He had control of it. Charles Woodson hits him. And the hit causes the fumble.
That ball did not look like it was slipping out of his hands. It was forced out by Woodson.
Once Walt was just taking so much time with the review, we knew that, okay, something is going to change. Something is going to happen right here.
Well, let's find out if my interpretation is right. I think it is, though, Greg, because we went over this rule quite extensively before the season started.
Meanwhile, more than 3,000 miles away in Southern California, syndicated sports columnist Norman Chad was watching the game from his couch and enjoying a glass of Cabernet or maybe a really perky Pinot Grigio. And this is where we get back to all those football fans who hate the Patriots today, because Chad began that game actually rooting for New England. Or more accurately, he was rooting against the Raiders and their owner, Al Davis. So he wasn't happy with Tom Brady's fumble in Foxborough, but he wasn't questioning it either.
There was 100% certainty that he had fumbled and that the game was over and we were all moving on with our lives.
Finally, referee Walt Coleman walked out onto the field to issue his ruling.
The quarterback's arm was going forward. It is an incomplete pass.
Coleman had invoked the tuck rule. Randy Pierce was thrilled, though 15 years later he says right call, bad rule. Norman Chad has stronger words for it.
It's easier to explain NATO than to explain the tuck rule, but essentially Tom Brady had brought the ball back in to his body. He was in a motion, a throwing motion, so he had not fumbled.
Chad had never been a fan of replay, but this one call forever changed the way he looked at the Patriots, too.
I was just so upset, even though I was rooting for the Patriots that day. I was so upset that replay had done this. And the moment that happened, and then the moment the Patriots particularly won the Super Bowl that year, you know, it's like my whole life's mission was rooting against the Patriots. It's a very small life, I'll admit, but that's the way it works.
Now, you might say, what's the big deal? Controversial calls happen all the time, and the Patriots were still behind. They had to go on to win that game and the game after that and the Super Bowl after that. But Norman Chad says...
Actually, it changed the course of National Football League history, probably. If the Patriots don't win that game, obviously they don't win the Super Bowl that year. If they don't win the Super Bowl that year, you have no idea how things unfold. It's like almost like a butterfly effect. They might not become the dynasty they've become over the last 15 years.
And if the Patriots didn't become a dynasty, Chad says, they probably wouldn't be hated so much right now. And no, he's not discounting all the other reasons why NFL fans hate the Patriots.
I call it Tuckgate. So besides Tuckgate, you know, we've had Spygate, we've had Deflategate. Any given hour of the day, you have Belichickgate. You know, I wouldn't even trust him to give me change at a toll booth. So all these things add up, and you just end up rooting against the Patriots most of the time that you're awake.
It took a while for the Patriots to accumulate all those gates, and the Tuck rule doesn't even exist anymore. The owners voted it out back in 2013. But since 2002, whenever New England has appeared in the Super Bowl, Norman Chad hasn't had to think too hard about who he'll be rooting for, and this year is no exception.
Even if I could not name a single player for the Atlanta Falcons, I would be rooting for the Falcons. I would root for a cold sore before I would root for the Patriots.
You can see my home is a little bit...
It's a little Patriot-centric, I gotta say.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to go back to Randy Pierce's living room for a moment, with all those walls covered in framed memories from four decades as a Patriots fan. Randy's feelings about the team and the league have gotten more complicated in recent years. He doesn't like how the game has become all about the money or the NFL's record on domestic violence and player safety. But almost all of New England's success has come since the Tuck Rule game, which means that Randy Pierce has never actually seen the most important photographs hanging on his walls.
So if I ever get sight back, and I don't bet on it, but, I mean, we do so many advances. Who knows, right?
Sure.
I'd love to be able to see all that. That'll be fun of this room to go through and find all the treasures.
And despite everything, Randy Pierce is hoping the Patriots give him one more moment worthy of wall space this weekend in Houston. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
We have lots more coming up on Only a Game. But first, Pam Stroud recently left a review of Only a Game on iTunes. Pam says, "Love this show. It never fails to elicit a smile, laugh, or tear." Thank you, Pam. If we've ever made you smile, laugh, or shed a tear, consider leaving a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners to find our show. It's time for three stories you should know. Well, actually, there's really only one super story this week, and unless you've been living in a cave with no Wi-Fi, you've already heard about it. Anyway, joining me this time around are WBUR Shira Springer and Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Shira, I understand that you are in Houston for some sort of contest. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm down here in Houston for the Super Bowl, and there has been a dizzying array of events, official NFL announcements, and press conferences. The latest announcement I received from NFL Communications, word that Super Bowl babies will be saluting Super Bowl legends in a 30-second commercial that will appear during the big game. Can't wait for that.
Super Bowl babies.
Yes. But seriously, the pace of news here, the bombardment of alerts for happenings big and small, reminds me a lot of the Trump administration and the IOC at the Olympics. The NFL, the IOC, and the White House seem to employ the same strategy when it comes to spin, namely, overload the media and hope they don't have time to ask the tough questions and dig deep into controversial issues. Roger Goodell's State of the NFL press conference on Wednesday provided a really good example of that. While Goodell took five questions about Deflategate, a few about franchise relocations, and one about loosening restrictions on marijuana use, the 40-minute press conference did not include a single question about concussions. And I'm curious, do you think by inundating the media, the NFL is intentionally distracting reporters from important issues?
I like the analogy, Trump administration to NFL. I think the rheumatologist who served for years as their concussion expert, that's the equivalent of Ben Carson running HUD. I think that the heads-up tackling program, that definitely seems like a Betsy DeVos innovation, grilled by Tim Kaine, not knowing what she's talking about. But I have been in those press conferences. When I say those, there is this one official press conference, and it's more like the Putin press conference. It is so stage-managed. And
yes.
you submit, not in writing, but someone will say, what do you want? A guy with an earpiece comes up to you and says, what do you want to ask about? Which is weird in a press conference to get a little bit of pre-screening. They don't exactly vet it. But of course, they could use this to steer away from anything they don't want. And also, they pick on the two or three maybe foreign journalists or crazy guys with their own pet issues who can distract you. And that's a tried and true press conference tactic. It has the veneer of the media asking Goodell questions. And there were tough questions, but there were questions about things he wanted to answer, like, how are you going to make the ratings rebound?
I don't doubt that the NFL is trying to do what you say the league is trying to do, Shira. But on the eve of the Super Bowl, I kind of wonder if the effort is necessary, because it seems to me that historically, at least, the public has demonstrated that they care enormously about such issues as domestic violence committed by players and brain injuries suffered by them until it's game time, at which point they put all those concerns aside, they grab some chips, they watch the game. When the bread is plentiful and the circus has begun, concerns with things like violence against women and the health of players just somehow melt away. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And that's part of the problem, that it's very hard to sustain media attention when so much is coming at you this week. This is the biggest week for the NFL. This is when all of the international attention is here. You know, a large portion of the country, despite what's going on in the White House, will be paying attention to this game. And I just wish that there was more attention paid to two issues in particular, domestic violence and concussions, because I think the NFL has an abysmal record with both of those issues. I don't care that the NFL doesn't want to talk to them, and I don't care that the NFL wants the shield to shine during this week.
I think that this has been the most suppressed Super Bowl that I've ever seen, and just world events overwhelming anything coming out of Houston. So as far as what Shira said, I think they are two very separate issues, similar in that they've been treated by the NFL in the same way, which is to obfuscate and deny. But the domestic violence issue is a societal issue that NFL teams could take the lead on. It would be nice if they did, but they clearly don't. But there are so many other sports leagues and so many other entities that are falling down on this. You know, as we remember, Ray Rice wasn't sentenced to anything in the courts. And so many of these cases, nothing came of it in terms of jail time or real penalties except diversion. So to ask the NFL to go beyond where society is, I think it would be nice if they did, but they're not doing it. Whereas concussions are entirely a football creation. And even though they will cite that concussions are down this year, and maybe they are compared to the baseline of the self-reported concussions, it's still a tremendous issue. And with youth football, they're doing these minuscule changes that really do seem more cosmetic than they are actual. And it's a horrifying thing.
You talk about it being the most suppressed Super Bowl ever. And what's been interesting here is questions have been asked about Trump, about the immigration ban, and about various other policies, including the relationship between U.S. and Mexico, because the Patriots and the Raiders will play next season in Mexico. And yet players, coaches, executives are shying away from even addressing or, in fact, acknowledging what's going on in the rest of the United States.
All right, Mike, it's your turn, and I understand we're still on football, right?
Yeah, so this is a tweak on what Shira was saying, but normally before the Super Bowl, I like football. I'm a fan of football, and I like the intellectual aspects and the coaching decisions that are made, the chess match, if you will. Oh, God, I apologize to everyone. But I have just been so uninvested. I normally listen to some in-depth podcasts, and I tried getting into it, and they were talking about A-gap pressure on Brady, and I was just so bored by it. And they were talking about how Atlanta uses its running backs, and might they use both running backs at a time on the same play when usually they don't.
But there's only one football, Mike. How could they do that?
It doesn't make any sense. What madness are you speaking? But my internal reaction was, why? I don't care. Why don't I care? Part of it's because I have been uninvested in the NFL all season. I thought it was a boring season. It was an extra boring postseason. But if ratings are down 8%, my interest is somewhere down 38%. I know it's not because Colin Kaepernick kneeled. I don't think it's because head trauma. I've found a way to live with that, whatever you want to call it, justify that, tell myself whatever stories I need to tell. But Last year, Denver against the Panthers, this 15-1 team, or Peyton Manning, and years before, every other year a Patriots team has gotten there, they've had these seemingly unstoppable offenses, occasionally to be stopped by a Giants team. And then in past years, the Saints have been in it, and the Buccaneers have been in it, and all these teams that have never been in it. And then I said to myself, well, the Falcons haven't been in it, but I lived in Atlanta, and they are not a loved team by that fan base. So it's just this confluence where, unless it was the Patriots against the Cowboys, and then there'd be a little juice for me, I have cared so much less about the intricacies of this Super Bowl than I've ever cared about a game before.
Shira, you're in the belly of the beast. Is there anybody down there who feels the same way Mike does?
No.
Good.
In my hotel, which also happens to be sort of ground zero for NFL activities, there are a lot of former players and current players staying, and you have people filtering in and celebrity watching. I mean, people here are just all NFL. The league can do no wrong. Everything is great. And you've got people wandering the streets in Brady jerseys and Matt Ryan jerseys and Ben Roethlisberger jerseys. I mean, this is just nirvana for NFL fans. And the game Sunday will be, you know, the height of it all.
Mike, I have to assume from what you've said that you're not a fan of the great and growing controversy concerning how uncomfortable one multimillionaire might be handing the trophy to another multimillionaire, despite the fact that they're corporate partners. I just find that utterly fascinating myself.
I'm with you. Yes. I'm with you, Bill.
That holds intrigue. And I also enjoy questioning my own beliefs. And this week when Donald Trump came out and said that Roger Goodell was not an intelligent person, I found myself saying, my God, I agree with Donald Trump. How do I sit with this? So that was interesting. It's just the AGAP pressure talk.
I wonder if the AGAP pressure talk is there to distract from, you know, all the other stuff and to keep the focus on the game and not let Deflategate take over the narrative.
What's wrong with a pass rush up the middle? Why can't we just say pass rush up the middle? Why does AGAP pressure express this better? I don't understand.
I want to take just a minute to help out the dozen or so people who won't be watching the Super Bowl. I haven't seen La La Land yet. I'm told it's very entertaining. Rogue One, Star Wars Story, is out if you haven't had your fill of space movies. Arrival, another possibility if you feel that way. I've been told Hidden Figures is wonderful. Going to have to check that out myself. I liked Lion. Nice story. Happy ending for everybody. And the Super Bowl, of course, only has a happy ending for the fans of one of the two teams. So Lion is at least twice as good as that. Go to the early show. Leave your phone home. Have a nice dinner at a restaurant where there are no TVs. And by the time you get home, you'll have missed the game. And if you really want to find out what happened, turn your phone on again and you can check out the highlights. Shira, is that enough to get me arrested or deported in the land where football is king?
Yes, but I've just been going over the game day logistics for covering this game, how early people will need to arrive to make sure they're there for kickoff, and I think you actually may be on to something. I am amazed at how many people are going to flood into the stadium and go through all the hassle to be there live for this experience. I'm not opposed to the movie option, I must say.
Binge watching on a Netflix or a Hulu or an Amazon, like there'll probably be less competition for the cable feed, that now might be the time to do it. Your House of Cards, your Americans, what have you.
Right. So either do that or patronize your local theater and restaurant and check everything out on the phone when you're finished.
Yes.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and WBUR's own Shira Springer, who also contributes to the Boston Globe. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
On page 39 of the May 1904 issue of the Caledonian Illustrated Family Magazine, you'll find a Gleanings of Humor column containing this gem. "There's poetry in everything," said the ecstatic poet. "That's true," replied the editor. "That basket over there is simply full of it." In that spirit, we now dig deeply into our brimming basket, the one we've been refilling since 1994, to delight fans of the gridiron and maybe the rest of you as well. Only a Game now proudly presents our 23rd installment of Super Bowl Haiku Poetry.
Only a game? No. Or, if so, Tyrannus Rex, only a lizard.
Say Atlanta wins. Takes the air out of the Pats. Are they suspended?
Falcons puff and preen. Welcome to the big stage, boys. Brady waits. Goodbye.
My kids love football. I don't understand the game. I do like nachos.
Tickets? I don't need no stinking tickets. I got big flat screen TV.
Super Bowl Sunday. There, I said it. So sue me. Uh-oh.
Oh, say, can you see?
Hey, NFL, CTE, PR, RIP.
Kick arches skyward, hovers, or seems to, and falls.
I wish it stayed up.
I like football, but mostly it's all about Velveeta.
Warmed slowly. Liquid gold.
New England. Deep thoughts home. Land of Emerson, Thoreau, Hawthorne, Belichick. Though it's not such a great poem, but don't tell Bill.
Falcons? Birds of prey? Better be birds that can pray. It's funny because...
Score enough, you win. Atlanta's mantra, score more. Then, score more than that.
In strange, distant lands, the big game goes unmentioned. No one cares.
What jerks.
New England once more. The commissioner on edge.
A Belichick, mate?
Yay, team! Play the sports! Run there and don't drop the ball!
Wait, who do we like?
Look, up on the roof. Is it a bird? A plane?
No!
It's Lady Gaga!
Up on the roof sings Lady Gaga.
Fly over. Better be careful.
Met my husband, not watching Super Bowl 29. Three kids now. Love you. Ooh.
Coach Belichick scowls. You'd think his puppy dog died. Instead, Pat's touchdown.
Birds drift. Fragile. Free. Above the roar and rumble. Until planes hit them.
Matty Ice standing, arm cocked, heartbeat steady. Pure as Mount Fuji snow.
No mere mortal man bestrides now the Super Bowl. But Belichick? Yes.
Oh, John Facenda.
Falcon, majestic. May soar, may capture small game. Big game, not so much.
Pats, down late. May wail in dreadful, sad unison.
Gronk, where is our Gronk?
Where is the ceiling on Brady's greatitudeness? Limits? Limits?
No.
Game yori. Gaga mite taberu. Piku nani?
Wow, that is the first Super Bowl haiku ever submitted to us in Japanese. Very cool. It translates to...
Not watching the game. Gaga and too much to eat. What is a pick six?
Bird and Minuteman clash in highly touted bout.
3 hours too long.
When Super Bowl ends, February goes on, on. Play it again, Sam.
Thanks to this year's Hut Hut Haiku players, Kelvin Brooks, Erica Lanz, Amory Severtson, George Hicks, Karen Miller Medson, Hitesh Hathi, Clint Kavanaugh, Hisana Kagoda, and Walter Dixon. And thanks also to all of the listeners who sent in their own haiku. Visit onlyagame.org to see whose submissions made the cut. Ahead on Only a Game, journalist Sean Assale was investigating the death of former heavyweight champion Sonny Liston when a mysterious letter appeared at his door.
In this envelope is a transcript given by an informant for the Las Vegas Police Department, and he says, "I know who killed Sonny Liston."
Did he know? Find out just ahead, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Speaking of which, I believe it's time for your much-anticipated annual proclamation.
The Super Bowl is good.
Earlier in the program, Karen Given explored why the Patriots are the most hated football team in the country. But on Thursday, I learned that Tom Brady's jersey is the NFL's bestseller. So are all those haters putting the jersey on dartboards or creating elaborate voodoo dolls?
Or burning them in the backyard.
I mean,
it's entirely possible that in their own genteel way, the Patriots have become the Raiders of the 21st century. So people wear their jerseys as some sort of outlaw rebellion move.
Back in 2008... the Patriots would have been a perfect 19-0 if only the New York Giants hadn't barely beaten them in the Super Bowl. And just last December, the Pats trademarked the phrases 19-0 and the perfect season. Why do this 9 years after it might have been a good idea?
Maybe they're going to find out that there's something wrong with the Giants' victory.
Ooh.
Maybe there's a secret plot out there somewhere.
Ooh, cool. Give the trophy back.
Either that or they think 2017 is going to be a heck of a season.
Maybe they're getting ready. The Atlanta Falcons, of course, have had a great season. You don't get to the Super Bowl without doing that. Great story, great team. But has that story so far been run over by the Patriots' Belichick, Brady, Goodell, Deflategate, Pursuit of History freight train?
Wow, that was hard to do.
It
Very
was.
Well done,
I practiced.
Bill.
I practiced.
A little bit. This is one of those things where you wait till the game starts and then you forget all the other stuff. It's mm-hmm. a fascinating matchup. All year, the Patriots' defense has been reckoned to be their weak spot at the same time. You know, it's played very well down the stretch. And Atlanta's going to be the most ferocious test they've had. So it should be a good game.
Art Briles, late the coach of the football team at Baylor University, announced this week that he is dropping his lawsuit against Baylor. He had maintained that he knew nothing about the sexual assaults committed by his players. We heard this week that the number of former players who allegedly committed, quote, acts of rape has risen to 31. Do you suppose that influenced the coach's decision to drop his lawsuit?
I suspect that's the case. I mean, it's pretty plainly right now Baylor deserves the NCAA death penalty. If they're going to come down as hard as they did on Penn State, this is preposterous. And the stonewalling from the university has been disgusting.
12, count them, 12 cities have applied for the next Major League Soccer franchise. St. Louis and San Diego are among them. Is this a we'll replace the departing NFL teams with MLS team strategy?
I think it is, and I think it's an interesting development in the history of the MLS. I mean, you've got two cities with stadiums they're not using at this point.
That's right. St. Louis, of course, has been a hotbed of soccer for some long period of time. I'm not familiar enough with San Diego to know if that's true of San Diego.
I suspect that San Diego, being a gathering spot for new citizens of many lands, would also be good now. But as you said, St. Louis has a long history.
President Trump's executive order regarding immigration continues to inspire athletes to say various things. Would you like to pick some representative reactions from the pile?
Well, I think certainly if you expand the definition of athletes to include coaches, Greg Popovich in San Antonio seems to be making an early run for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. He's been very outspoken, as has LeBron James, and of course, there's been a radio silence from the NFL because nobody there is allowed to have an opinion.
I've even seen people from the mixed martial arts community
yes.
commenting on this. It's been fascinating to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is something that everyone who was not born here can sympathize with.
And finally, Charlie, veteran sportscaster Brent Musburger called his last game for ESPN this week, but it didn't take him long to find another job. He will headline VSIN, which calls itself, quote, the first media network dedicated to sports betting information. So I don't know if that's a good fit, but it certainly sounds thrilling, doesn't it?
Well, Brent was notable for, you know, during his broadcast. Al Michaels does this too, by the way, for noticing the impact of certain plays on what we would gracefully, our friends at the American Gaming Association, would call the line. So I think Brent's found a great place to land in his retirement.
I guess he probably called the American Gaming Association first and there were no openings.
I suspect he may be on the board of directors, actually.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and of course he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Lots of boxers can say they never had it easy. Sonny Liston, the heavyweight champion of the world for a little while in the early 60s, is among them.
He was born the 24th of 25 children in Forest City, Arkansas, a place so poor his father was a sharecropper that his arrival in the world was not documented with a birth certificate.
Author and journalist Sean Assale has learned a lot about Sonny Liston. Lots of other people know a little, that Liston fought Muhammad Ali twice, for example. In the first of those fights in 1964, Liston lost his heavyweight title.
We're waiting for that bell for round one. Here we go.
In the second, in 1965, he tumbled to the canvas after what some observers called the phantom punch, meaning he fell over as soon as the opportunity presented itself, and he stayed down, enraging Ali.
Jersey Joe Walcott. Sonny cannot move.
Maybe those people who know a little are also aware that Sonny Liston died in 1970, allegedly of a heroin overdose, and that he was dead in his bed in his house in Las Vegas for about a week before his wife came home and found him. Some of the material in Liston's life story might have worked as well in fiction. Take, for example, the way Liston got into boxing after he'd gone to prison for, as Assale puts it, beating people over the head with a lead pipe for 5 cents.
There was a priest who took a shining to Sonny, got him into the sort of sports program at the penitentiary, and found that Sonny had an aptitude for boxing. You know, he punched with the force of a government crash test.
Which was fine as long as Liston was in jail being managed by a priest. He got to be pretty good at knocking people down within the rules, too good to be ignored when he got out.
And in the 40s when this happens, there's only one way for a boxer to really get ahead, and that's by being sponsored by the mob.
In the early 50s, Liston hooked up with John Vitale. Among other things, Vitale ran a local union having to do with cement, among other things.
Vitale had him, got him a union card and a job for $25 a week working at the cement local. Of course, Sonny never really hauled cement. What he did is anytime there was a strike breaker or anybody who needed their legs broken, Sonny would show up with Vitale. Whether or not Sonny actually broke legs, I don't know. But throughout his life, all that really matters is once he stared at you, you felt as if your legs were going to be broken.
The excitement of Liston's early days aside, Assale became especially interested in the final year of the ex-champ's life when Liston was living in Las Vegas.
You have to envision him. He's at the back end of his career, but still a formidable face, and people recognize him, and he has a place at the International Hotel. You know, he'd stake himself out at the Kino Lounge there, let people gawk at him, and he'd sell, you know, $50 bags of cocaine. And you could buy cocaine from Sonny Liston. He lived on a golf course in a white suburb, and his neighbors were movie stars and casino executives. But at night, he'd drive to the shiftless soul of the ghetto. And he didn't just drive. He drove his pink Cadillac convertible right down the strip.
One of the places where Sonny parked his Cadillac was owned by a fellow named Earl Cage, who was either a beautician who sold cocaine or a cocaine dealer who did some hairdressing. One wrong night, well after Sonny Liston had lost to Ali for the second time, he found himself in Earl Cage's place. He probably wasn't looking for a trim.
And when the cops busted Earl Cage, there were several people in the house. Oddly, Sonny, who was there, was the only one who was let go. And Earl Cage thought that Sonny had set him up. And it very likely could have been Earl Cage who arranged for Sonny's murder.
Sean Assale doesn't buy the official story that Sonny Liston died of a drug overdose. For one, Asale thinks the Las Vegas police planted the heroin in Liston's house after his body was discovered. Beyond that, Asale feels like there were just too many dubious characters like Cage who felt they'd be better off, safer, if Sonny Liston was dead. It could also have been another dealer who'd done business with Sonny. The dealer's son told Asale that he and Sonny had used heroin together on various occasions, or perhaps somebody else altogether. Maybe somebody who thought Liston had cheated him after Sonny got into the business of selling drugs himself.
There were five, six people who plausibly could have done this.
As he became entangled in the various possibilities, Sean Asale began to feel as if he'd stumbled into a real live game of Clue. He knew he had the makings of a book, and every time he began to despair that the book might not have a definitive ending, he'd find yet another lead.
I had this constellation of characters. The other character we haven't gotten to yet, and I'll just say briefly, was a casino executive named Ash Resnick, who the FBI had long considered a fixed point between the mob and boxing, and a lot of people think that Ash Resnick might have taken a contract out on Sonny.
So he had Cage and Resnick and those other five or six people Sonny'd antagonized in one way or another, and he had a story about how Sonny, drunk one night, had bragged that by staying on the canvas that night in 1965, while Muhammad Ali shouted at him to get up, Sonny had insured himself a slice of Ali's future purses. Elementary boxing economics. And it's not hard to imagine that by blurting that out, Liston had perhaps given several other people motives to kill him. So Asale began again to think the story of the mystery of Sonny Liston's death would offer his readers only the opportunity to guess which bad guy had been bad enough to add murder to his resume. And then, one day, the mail arrived.
I get an envelope sent to me with no return address. And in this envelope is a transcript given 11 years after Sonny's death, and it's given by an informant for the Las Vegas Police Department, and he's pointing the finger, and he says, "I know who killed Sonny Liston. This person told me he killed Sonny Liston."
The informant had fingered a former Las Vegas police officer famous for the drug busts he'd made by pretending to be an addict. In case you've lost count, we're up to over half a dozen potential bad guys who could have killed Liston or paid somebody else to do it. Anyway, Asale learned that the retired police officer, whose name was Larry Gandy, had reportedly gone into business for himself, and the informant claimed the rogue officer had said he'd been hired to kill Sonny. The informant had died in his garage in a car full of carbon monoxide after who knows who had turned the key in the ignition. But Larry Gandy, the ex-cop, was still around.
You know, I put my best investigative hat on and my trench coat, and I sent him an email. How? Through Facebook. That's where I found him. And I sent him an email, and I said, "Would you like to talk to me?" And the last third of the book is really what happened when he wrote me back and said, "Sure, I've been carrying this stone around for 30 years. I drove to Red Rock, which is right outside of Las Vegas, knocked on his door. He opened it up looking like Santa Claus in the off-season. And you know, he threw an arm around me, and the first words out of his mouth were, 'I guess you're here to ask me if I killed Sonny Liston.'"
You're hoping the answer to that question was yes, right? I mean, who needs a game of Clue that doesn't end with everybody knowing that Colonel Mustard did it with a candlestick in the drawing room? But real life wouldn't cooperate. Larry Gandy said he didn't do it. But he didn't buy the overdose story. He liked Earl Cage for the hit. You remember Earl Cage, right? Beautician and cocaine dealer. In the simplest terms, Sean Asale knew the end of the story before he began telling it. Sonny Liston, once the heavyweight champ, died at the age of who knows what some days before December 30th, 1970. A lot of his life was mysterious and messy, and his death was too. Maybe he was murdered. Maybe he was lost.
He never knew when he came into the world, and I think he spent most of his life wondering why he was in it.
You want to take it any further, you might start with Sean Asale's book, The Murder of Sonny Liston, Las Vegas, Heroin, and Heavyweights. Okay, one more Super Bowl story. Just one. Things not going to happen again for 12 months. The New England Patriots, I know, the Patriots again, but folks who hate them should bear with me on this one. It bears repeating. Bears. Anyway, the Patriots finished the 1985 regular season 11-5. Not bad, not great, just good enough to earn the opportunity to play in the wild card game against the Jets, Another couple invited my wife and me over for the game, and they made homemade pizza. Terrific. The Pats sacked the Jets 5 times, forcing 4 turnovers. I didn't remember that. I had to look it up, but I do remember the pizza. Terrific. Somebody decided that we'd brought the Pats good luck by watching the game together, so we made plans to gather the following weekend to watch the Pats play the Raiders, who'd beaten New England by 15 points during the regular season. I had to look that up, too. Anyway, this time it was at our house, and I made chili. The Pats won again, and it was on to the AFC Championship against the Dolphins, who maybe had heard about the karma operating when this other couple said that we'd better come to their house for pizza again, since by then it was that obvious that we were driving the good vibes. Again, the pizza was excellent, better than excellent, and so were the Pats. They scored early and often and won the game by 17 points. That made 3 road wins in a row, which was something special. Although not perhaps as special as the pizza. Nah, forget the perhaps. Anyway, next stop, Super Bowl XX. Maybe I shouldn't have made chili again that day, but who argues with mystical forces? Some people don't change their socks during a winning streak. Some people make chili again. The Pats scored first in that Super Bowl, a field goal. I didn't have to look that up. I remember it. And then the Bears scored 44 unanswered points. I did look that up. I knew it was a lot, but 44, man. After the game, none of us wanted to sit through, even though there was plenty of chili and cookies, I think. I had to drive to the radio station and record a commentary. On the way, I tried to think of something clever to say about a hopelessly one-sided, anticlimactic football game. And on the radio, one of the commentators, a former Patriot, I think, said if it had been a prize fight, they'd have stopped it. He was right. I used his line. I think I gave him credit for it. I'll have to look that up. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. Our final word, performed by a member of the Only a Game Hut Hut Haiku Players, comes from listener Cara Bell.
Never a fan, then NPR light-bulbed haiku. Cheers!
Now it's a game.
Thank you, Kara. We're glad that said light bulb is still burning brightly 23 years after we first turned it on. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.